20-5764, Dominique Cordell Wallace versus United States of America. Arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Glick for the appellant.
Morning. How are you?
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Colia Glick for appellant Dominique Wallace, and I reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Approximately 3 years ago, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the criminal defendants in two landmark criminal law cases. Those were United States versus Davis and Rahafe versus United States. Mr. Wallace is entitled to relief under both cases.
Are you okay with our, I looked this morning, it didn't look like we got Taylor today. Are you okay with our just waiting for Taylor, and if we want to have some briefing, we do it then?
Yes, certainly, Your Honor.
Okay.
I plan to focus.
So let's focus on Rahafe. Great.
Will do. On Rahafe, this court's presented with an uncontested error. The district court's reasoning, the government doesn't defend the district court's reasoning. All parties agree that Rahafe applies retroactively on collateral review. This court should hold as much. And so really the only question is the government's alternative argument for procedural default. And we have two bases to overcome procedural default, both cause and prejudice and actual innocence. And I'll start with cause and prejudice because Mr. Wallace's unique procedural posture.
I go right to prejudice.
Will do. And on prejudice, there are four features of this case that make it distinct and that lead to a reasonable probability that if Mr. Wallace had been informed of the knowledge of status element, he would not have pleaded guilty.
What's the standard? Isn't it, it's higher than the plain air standard on direct appeal, right? Because I thought it was actual prejudice. Is that just reasonable probability again?
So I think there's two ways to look at the prejudice prong here. One is if we look at the cause being the ineffective assistance of counsel, then the prejudice could be seen as, you know, the grant of the cert petition that would have come and that other defendants in Mr. Wallace's position received. That could be the prejudice. Alternatively, it could be the prejudice he would need to satisfy plain error review, which is where Mr. Wallace would have been if he had filed that cert petition and then the Supreme Court had granted
it. Doesn't he obviously lose anyway under this new standard? I mean, you know, he's guilty of attempted murder. He knew he was a felon. I think he said that. So what we're getting at.
No, Your Honor, he did not say that. And we think he did not, especially the three factors here, particularly the length of his sentence on that attempted murder conviction, the predicate offense, was zero prison time.
Yeah, but suspended sentence when you've been in jail for 3 years, is that really a reasonable way to think about it?
Well, Your Honor, here's what the majority in Rahafe said.
It's still attempted murder.
Yes, Your Honor, but
that's another slight problem.
Certainly, but felony is defined in terms of the severity of the sentence, not the abstract severity of the offense itself. So Mr. Wallace received a suspended sentence. He walked out of that courtroom.
Having been in jail for 3 years.
Certainly, Your Honor. But
so he's saying, he's running around town saying it got off with a zero sentence, and they're saying, well, George, where have you been the last 3 years? Oh, yeah, well, I was in jail. Not much of a zero sentence.
Yes, Your Honor, but he was not sentenced. The sentence that the district court imposed was less than a year. It was a suspended sentence. And in Rahafe, the majority explained that Section 922 should not be read to, quote, apply to a person who is convicted of a prior crime but sentenced only to probation who does not know that the crime is punishable by imprisonment for a term exceeding 1 year. That is this case. He was sentenced only to probation in that predicate.
Is it reasonable to think that pleading guilty to attempted murder is for a sentence that's more than a year, given that you actually were in jail for 3 years?
Well, we submit that there needs to be something beyond the mere fact of conviction. That's what Rahafe holds.
What do you do? Have you talked about his plea, the document that says petition to enter plea of guilty? This is a document that he signed, and it says count one, first degree murder, attempted class A felony. So he signed a document that says he's pleading guilty to first degree murder, attempted class A felony. How is that not, I mean, I assume that it says his lawyer went over this document with him. It says first degree murder, attempted class A felony. His signature is on the last page. And he still doesn't know that it was a felony?
there's at least a reasonable probability that he did not know. So in addition to the length of his sentence, he was a juvenile when he committed that offense. He was 17 years old when the predicate offense occurred. And of course, we're not contesting that it does not qualify as a felony, but it is reasonable for Mr. Wallace to assume or to believe subjectively that that offense did not qualify as a felony. And he had other juvenile delinquencies on his record. And I know it's a little counterintuitive, but the fact that none of those counted may have led Mr. Wallace to believe that this predicate felony did not count either for purposes.
The same plea agreement, doesn't it say he's being tried as an adult?
I believe it's a different document, Your Honor, but yes, it does. But again, Mr. Wallace has a fourth or fifth grade education level.
Also a lot of experience with the juvenile court system. I mean, this isn't his first rodeo, as they say.
Certainly. But the fact that none of those other offenses counted, and we cited some cases from Tennessee Supreme Court saying, hey, judges disagree about whether and under what circumstances felony convictions actually qualify for sentencing enhancement.
Well, how about, let's say it was first degree murder. Everything else is the same. Would it be fair to say, you know, Mr. Wallace knew, there's every chance that he knew he was a felon?
So, no, Your Honor, and no? Section 922 G1 defines felony in terms of the length of sentence.
Right, but, you know, I mean, certain offenses you're going to assume if you commit them, you could be sentenced for more than a year, right? Well, I mean, is it your position that categorically there's no sentence in the world, no offense in the world for which we can impute knowledge to the to a defendant that, hey, you know, you could have been sentenced to prison for more than a year?
Your Honor, the definition of felony is framed in terms of the severity of sentence, not the severity of offense. And if I may borrow a little bit from the Davis argument, we're in sort of a category.
There's a correlation between those two things.
How would you define, you know, the severity? This offense is enough. This felony is enough, but this felony is not enough. We get into sort of a, what is the generic nature of this offense and things like that, which the Supreme Court has cautioned against. And in fact, that's the reason.
Subjectively believe, is that the inquiry?
Yes, Your Honor. Under Rahafe, it must be subjective knowledge of status. And that's what we need.
There's no objective
It's interesting.
Qualification of that?
Your Honor, Justice Alito had similar concerns. He raised those concerns. Someone could be willfully ignorant, not open their mail, not know that their status had changed.
Yeah.
And that is the logical.
What about, I mean, how can you say subjective and then back to Judge Murphy's question where you sign something that says felony?
Well,
and then you sign something that says adult, and you sign something that says attempted murder, and you've been in jail for the last 3 years. You would still say, well, you know, he doesn't have a good education, and it's just a question of what he thought. And here's the affidavit, which says he didn't think this could be punishable by more than a year.
Right. And so
what's the answer? Always is a trump card, the affidavit that says I didn't think I could be punishable by more than a year?
I think that's sort of a separate question for actual innocence, but I would take it back to Section 2255B, which says, unless the motion and files and records of this case conclusively show that petitioner is entitled to no relief, then a hearing must be granted. And our position here is that we've done enough. Mr. Wallace has these unique factors that do enough to create a dispute of fact on the issue of knowledge or the issue of whether or not he would have entered that plea agreement. And another point on this is that he pleaded open. So he received no benefit from his plea of guilty.
Well, you know, the law usually doesn't work this way, even with subjective standards. I mean, that's kind of like the point of Holmes's Common Law, that iconic book. The whole point is that every subjective standard actually is objective. Because if you look at certain facts, you say, that person must have known. If I point a gun at a person and pull the trigger, I must know that the near certain effect of that is I'm going to shoot that person. And so even if that person all day long says, no, I didn't know I was going to shoot him, that subjective standard is met by objective facts. And it would seem like the same thing is probably true here. I mean, he could say all day long he didn't know he could go to jail for more than a year for attempted murder, but those objective facts are enough to to conclude otherwise.
So
that's the way the law usually works, on subjective standards.
Certainly, Your Honor, and 2 points in response. The first is that there must be, rehafe must mean something. It can't be just the fact that you were convicted.
Right? But what it could mean is, hey, look at the circumstances, and if there's a real question about whether, you know, sort of this, you know, second degree assault while intoxicated or something, you know, if there's a real question whether this guy might have known, then that's one thing. But attempted murder is a tough spot.
Yeah, I don't think not applying rehafe to attempted murder destroys rehafe at all.
No, but I think in terms of the severity of the sentence, in terms of Mr. Wallace's unique position as a juvenile, and then we also have his 2255 petition, which is verified, and which said, I didn't know that I was forbidden to possess a firearm, citing rehafe. And so the logical inference of that is I didn't know I was forbidden to possess a firearm because I didn't know I was a felon. So we have his affidavit as well. And again, I'd point to Justice Alito's dissent. I mean, he disagreed. He was sort of stringing out the parade of horribles.
I'm not a big fan of the law means the opposite of dissents. I got to tell you, after 19 years, that's one of the most absurd concepts I've ever come across. Dissenters are angry. They're frustrated. They say lots of things. So I'm glad you told us, but you've told us twice, and probably all I need.
Understood, Your Honor. I guess what I would say is that Justice Alito got it right, and that the logical implication of rehafe is that a petitioner like my client who claims actual innocence is entitled to a hearing on factual innocence.
But rehafe was about a jury trial. Of course your client would be entitled to have the jury resolve beyond a reasonable doubt at the initial stage. But what we're talking about now is just the actual prejudice standard. And it strikes me that it's much more of a pragmatic standard. We look at all the evidence, and here it's very difficult for me to see that there would be any theory in which he would not have known when he signed the plea agreement saying it's a felony that was a 10-year suspended sentence.
So
even under whatever standard it is, rehafe's core meaning is not at this stage. It's at the main stage, which is the jury gets to decide your client's subjective knowledge. We're past that. It wasn't raised. It's been defaulted. We're now at a prejudice. Would he have been helped by this new element? And I'm looking at this signature, and it clearly says he was agreeing to plead guilty to a felony.
Certainly, Your Honor. And I think, again, I would take it back to 2255B, which the district court may very well at that evidentiary hearing, and this was my second point to Your Honor's question, may very well decide, no, this is implausible. There was no prejudice here. Mr. Wallace clearly knew. We could hear testimony from his counsel saying, yes, I informed him. This is how it went down. But we don't have that here, and the record does not conclusively show that he's entitled to no relief, which is why we're not asking for vacater. We're not asking this court to decide that question. We're asking for a remand on this evidentiary hearing.
Okay, thank you. Government. Morning.
Morning. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Cecil Van Devender on behalf of the United States. So I'll start with 2 points of agreement. We do agree that the district court erred when it relied on principles of non-retroactivity and waiver to deny the rehafe claim. And we agree that you have discretion, should you choose to do so, to remand for further proceedings. But my goal is to persuade you that the more appropriate course on this record is simply to affirm the denial of the rehafe claim.
On the first claim, just real quick, you also agree that it all depends on Taylor. There's no distinguishing factor.
Oh, we do, Your Honor. We do. So I think the court already touched on a number of the factors from the underlying state court proceedings that show that this was clearly a felony and that any knowledge of status claim would be completely implausible here. So there's the fact that although my colleague has described this as kind of a non-custodial sentence, probationary sentence.
But why completely implausible if it's subjective?
Well, I think, you know, this sort of gets to Judge Kethledge's point. Partly it's, you know, in any fact finder, of course, have to look at the objective facts and infer the state of mind, potentially based on what Mr. Wallace says about his state of mind, but also based on other circumstantial evidence. So that would include, for example, that he actually served 3 years in custody, was sentenced to 10 years in the custody of the Tennessee Department of Corrections with the balance of the remaining time suspended. There is the fact that page writing number 58 of the 2255 record. So the state court judge who took the guilty plea and imposed the sentence says, I affirm that Mr. Wallace understands the penalties associated with the count he is pleading guilty to, Class B felony under Tennessee law, mandatory minimum of 8 years in prison, maximum of 30 years. So the fact that he was told that, the judge affirms on the record, he appears to understand all of this, that further undercuts any suggestion that he might have mistakenly believed that this was a misdemeanor, not punishable by more than a year in prison. And again, he served 3 full years before the balance of his sentence is suspended.
He signs an affidavit saying, I thought I was allowed to own a gun, and that wouldn't have been true if you were a felon. And so doesn't that affidavit kind of show, support his subjective views? I mean, that he was a juvenile, he actually didn't serve any more time after the plea agreement. I don't know, I mean, you said not plausible, and I'm just trying to figure out, is that really so?
Well, I think it could be a different case if what Mr. Wallace had done in his 2255 is say, I never knew that I had previously been convicted of a felony, and here's why. Let me explain why.
Why isn't that a fair inference? Don't we draw inferences? Can't we draw the inference from what he did say, that I thought I could own a gun? That had to mean he didn't think he was a felon?
I don't think so. I think what he is saying here is basically a reading of Rahif that other, you know, that defense attorneys have suggested down the, at various points that this court has rejected. Essentially, I wasn't told that I was legally prohibited from possessing a firearm, which is a very different factual allegation than I never knew that what I was convicted of was a felony offense. So I think any kind of fair reading of what he alleges is actually misses the mark of the underlying Rahif allegation. I didn't know my knowledge of status versus I didn't know about the legal prohibition that followed from that factual status.
What? So this case really is about not so much the merits at this point, but just whether to remand for an evidentiary hearing.
That's right, Your Honor.
So what is your view of what amount of information has to be presented in order to get an evidentiary hearing? So why wouldn't this affidavit suffice?
Again, I think it would be a very different case if, and he didn't actually really file an affidavit, he filed an AO-243 form that simply says, I was never told that I was legally prohibited. Had he filed an affidavit that actually kind of had some meat on the bone, said, look, you know, I acknowledge that what I was convicted of was a felony, but at the time of the hearing, I was, you know, heavily medicated, I wasn't paying attention, my lawyer later told me that this was a misdemeanor, you know, you could put some meat on the bones.
Is it analogous to Twombly, like the 12b6? Like you have to plausibly state, I mean, it's in 2055, it's not really that context, but you have to plausibly state a claim in order to get past what is the initial, just review the papers stage?
I think that's right, Your Honor, and there's a little bit of case law on this. It talks about how an assertion is kind of necessary but not sufficient if the district court reviews the record and says, you know, look, he makes these allegations, but these allegations are clearly contrary to the record or simply implausible, then no hearing is warranted. So it's not a very high bar, but there is a bar. It's not enough to simply say, I didn't know I was legally prohibited. May I have my hearing now, please? There needs to be some kind of meat on the bones to warrant a hearing. And some of that is left to the district court's discretion, sir.
I was going to say, would that be abuse of discretion review? Because the district court here relied on a completely different rationale.
That's right.
So, well, how does the fact that it's abuse of discretion review play into that?
So here I would agree that there was no discretionary judgment about whether to have a hearing because it's sort of legally non-cognizable. So there's not, I wouldn't ask the court to affirm the denial of the hearing on discretionary grounds, but in order to decide whether a hearing is warranted, the court would first have to decide these kind of threshold issues, including procedural default, which I think, again, is plain from the record. And then when you get into kind of cause and prejudice, that's when these merits issues about kind of how plausible the claim is come into play. The other point I wanted to respond to is this kind of issue of, well, he got nothing by pleading guilty, and so why wouldn't he have rolled the dice with a trial had he known that knowledge of status was an element? By pleading guilty, he got his 3 acceptance of responsibility points, and that's actually really important here because prior to acceptance, his offense level is 43, which meant he faced an advisory guidelines range of life imprisonment, and with the 924J conviction, which has a statutory max of life, a life sentence was very much in play here. By pleading guilty, getting the 3 points, he moved from 43 to 40, guideline range of 360 to life, and he got a 360-month sentence. So I dispute the fact that, you know, there's no incentive to plead guilty had he known. And again, when you look at kind of The fact that he was perfectly happy to plead guilty and acknowledge his felony status, but would he have gone to trial simply to argue to the jury, yes, a month before the crimes in question, I was convicted of second-degree murder. Now the jury, of course, hears about the underlying facts of the second-degree murder, the sentence he got. The notion that he would have not pleaded guilty and gone to trial just to put that before the jury, I think, is again, highly implausible. And so really what we're asking the court to do here is kind of follow what the Supreme Court did in Greer. There, you know, the main dispute between the majority and Justice Sotomayor's separate concurrence was, should we remand this to the lower courts, have them apply this rule, or should we just decide it on this record? The court said, you know, we have enough before us, we can look at the record as a whole. There's, you know, he hasn't carried his burden of showing that he suffered prejudice from the Rahaif error. Let's affirm on this record. So that's essentially what we're asking the court to do here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, Mr. Van Vender. Okay. Mr. Glick, get some rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to start with Judge Murphy's point, the standard. I think it's interesting. I've thought about it a lot. What is prejudice here? I think at a minimum, it's plain error review. Because if that cert petition had been filed, he would have gotten plain error review on remand from the Supreme Court, as the Supreme Court did in countless other cases. And then on plain error review, Rahaif is not limited to trial. There's a growing body of case law, and I'll cite one case for the court that it's not in our briefs, United States versus Black, 845 Federal Appendix 42. It's from the Second Circuit. Courts reverse on plain error review usually when the sentence was less than 1 year on the predicate felony, just like in Mr. Wallace's case, just like the court noted in Rahaif. When the sentence is less than a year, there's at least a possibility, and we'd submit a reasonable probability in this case, that Mr. Wallace did not know that, in fact, he was a felon. The other point is just on remand.
Do any of those cases involve suspended sentences like this one?
I am not aware of that at the moment. I know some of them do involve juvenile convictions and other misdemeanor convictions that were mixed in, similar to what Mr. Wallace has here, where he may not have known the difference. He submitted in his 2255 petition that he's not good at law. He did not understand some of the implications of his at least of his argument here. So we submit that those are entitled to a liberal construction and that his assertion of actual innocence warrants a hearing, particularly when combined with the unique features of his case.
Okay, thanks to both of you for your helpful arguments and briefs. And Mr. Click, I see you're court appointed, and you know, Mr. Wallace is incredibly lucky to have you. And thank you so much the brief is terrific. Your argument was great. You stood your ground, which is always terrific and not always easy. So thank you very much, and it's a great service to the system.
It's truly an honor to be here. Thank you.
All right. Thanks to both of you. The case will be submitted, and the clerk may adjourn.